This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Matt Herman in Bonn. Coming up, we'll look at how the European Union can make its displeasure known about Moscow's handling of its corruption-clouded elections without upsetting their vital trade relationship. We'll also look at what lies behind the UK's decision to veto an EU treaty change.
I think you can certainly see this event as being part of a continued pattern of Britain's attitude to Europe, an inability to articulate a vision of what an increasingly integrated Europe will look like. We reject that idea, or we tend to feel quite uncomfortable with it.
And we'll find out how the reputation of the loser in the century-old race to the South Pole, a Briton, incidentally, is being rehabilitated in the eyes of a Norwegian. Those stories and more coming up. We'll begin this week in Brussels, where Russian President Dmitry Medvedev met with EU leaders. The agenda as it had originally been planned was to focus on trade issues, visa harmonization, and the two sides' respective response to events in Syria. But looming rather larger now is the Russian government's own handling of recent parliamentary elections. Accusations of fraud have been widespread, and the protest movement that has followed is unprecedented in scale since Vladimir Putin took power more than a decade ago. So the EU certainly talks a good game when it comes to promoting democracy and civil society issues in smaller countries like Belarus or Libya. What role do they have to play when Russia, among their biggest energy suppliers, falls short of their standards? Earlier, I rang Arkady Moshes, the director of the EU's Eastern Neighborhood and Russia Research Program at the Finnish Institute of International Affairs. I asked him how the present political foment in Russia might affect its relations with the EU.
Well, I think it's too early to tell, and the one coming months will not change much. And the whole period until the presidential elections may have an impact. But fortunately or unfortunately, the instinctive reaction of the European Union that we've witnessed so far was one, business as usual. European Union, Brussels tried to ignore what was happening in Moscow to the extent possible. I had a chance to ask this question in several Brussels audiences, the why, when Mr. Lukashenko puts 1,000 people in jail, EU suspends their relationship in Belarus, and why, when the same is happening on the streets of Moscow and St. Petersburg, EU keeps preparing the partnership summit as if nothing happened. So I think EU is not yet ready to accept that the changes have seriously started.
Now, you just made a comparison yourself between what is now happening in Russia and what has happened in the recent past in Belarus. And the way that the EU has reacted to the situation in Belarus has been to try and isolate Lukashenko and his government. Is doing that to Russia, which is so large and so economically important, is that even realistic to try and isolate them in that way?
I don't think that isolation is a possibility. I mean, practical engagement, transactional relationship will continue. Russia cannot stop selling energy to Europe. Europe cannot stop buying energy from Russia. Pragmatic economic cooperation will continue no matter what. So full isolation is not an option. What is an option is kind of a statement of the own position and to say clearly that EU would not deal with the regime that would be willing at some stage rely on violence against their own people. It would be very appropriate, but this has not been done. The perception of the current position in EU position in Russia by the Russian protesters is the business as usual. And this is good because, in the one sense, because this will help the Russian people to understand that the change in Russia is Russians' own business. But this is also not so good because it sends probably distorting signals to the regime.
What do you make of one of the more internationally covered developments of this week in Russia? That is the candidacy of Mikhail Prokhorov. Is he a legitimate candidate in that he has not really held political office before? And is he going to offer any kind of real alternative to in the leadership style of United Russia as we have come to know it?
Well, the answer is we don't know. This is a very intriguing situation, and his decision to run opens a lot of potentially interesting twists in the next months. But we don't know if he is running as a really genuine contender to Mr. Putin and the system of governance in Russia, or whether he is running as a spoiler. I mean, unfortunately, it is possible to argue both ways. I don't know whether or not he could be a strong candidate, even if he ran kind of as a serious contender. But there is one point on which he can build his platform, that he's so rich that he doesn't need to be corrupt. That might be appealing to voters at the moment.
The smell of corruption hangs very thick over the elections that we had just saw the last weekend. And is there any reason for us to believe that the result of a presidential election in several months' time will be any more clear or clean than the one that we just saw?
If the social mobilization goes on, and it's quite possible that it will, because I think the critical threshold, the threshold of fear, has been overcome. There might be a better monitoring. There might be better control by the society. And I think the possibility that Mr. Putin, who is still the front runner and who is still the strongest candidate objectively, the possibility that he will have to go into a second round is fairly serious. And if there is a second round, but Mr. Putin wins in the second round, then the politics will be back to Russia, because it will be self-evident that he is not the omnipotent ruler of the past decade, but a president who will have to probably make compromises or at least debate. It's very difficult to believe now that elections will be again fair and free, but it is already possible to hope that falsifications will be less than before.
Arkady Moshes, who studies the Russia-EU relationship at the Finnish Institute of International Affairs there. Incidentally, word has come out of that Russia-EU summit that Moscow is offering to contribute at least 10 and perhaps as much as $20 billion to the expanded Eurozone bailout fund. I suppose there are many ways to read that, but the Eurozone, those 17 countries that use the euro as their currency, could certainly do with the money. It's been a dreadful year for them, one in which a debt crisis spread from Greece to Italy, banks panicked, and despite endless rounds of summits, European leaders have seemed incapable of restoring confidence. Now, the first steps have been taken, though, to build a so-called fiscal union. But will that be enough to stave off a meltdown in 2012? Our Brussels correspondent, Vanessa Mock, mulls that question.
It's been the year of the crisis summit. European Union heads of state have met in Brussels 8 times as the debt crisis continued to spiral. Earlier this month, the leaders of France and Germany, the duo at the helm of the Eurozone train, came up with their master plan. A new EU treaty would be drawn up to impose tighter fiscal controls on Eurozone countries, and fiscal slackers would be hit with sanctions. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel pushed the most for this new fiscal union, in a bid, she said, to restore trust in the single currency.
I've always said that the 17 Eurozone countries must restore their credibility. And I think that with these measures, that can and will be done. We've done it in such a way that any country can sign up, whether or not they are part of the Eurozone.
But the new treaty has already sparked a major fallout with Britain, and diplomats in Brussels say some other member states are getting cold feet. Sonny Kapoor, managing director of the Redefine consultancy, explains why.
What we have moved towards instead is everybody be like Germany. It's not even fiscal coordination. You are trying to make every country follow similar fiscal policy. You cannot have a fiscal union without any discussion of either risk sharing or some possible transfer mechanism from the stronger to a weaker member. That's how fiscal union such as the United States works like. That is how a fiscal union such as India works like.
Markets are similarly dubious. Euro bonds have been swept off the table, and many are now asking, where is that big bazooka that we were promised? David Jones is a market strategist at IG Markets in London.
Markets have felt that maybe the European crisis, the debt crisis, has got ahead of politicians again, and politicians have been concerned about changing the treaties and changing the conditions rather than actually trying to get a grip on the crisis. So I think that's those sort of conversations about changing treaties for when we've got a handle on the crisis.
The big hope underpinning this new fiscal union is that it would encourage the European Union Central Bank to step in to prop up the Eurozone's struggling economies. But whenever he's asked about this, the ECB's chief, Mario Draghi, is singularly evasive.
It will be the basis for a good fiscal compact and more disciplined economic policy in the euro area members.
Soon after it became clear that Greece would need a second bailout this summer, alarm bells also started ringing in the far larger eurozone economies of Italy and Spain. Italy's borrowing costs soared, and former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi backtracked on promises to push through reforms. The arrival of his successor, Mario Monti, has done a lot to restore confidence. But the big question remains, will Greece, Italy and others be able to borrow on the markets next year and keep their heads above their debts? Andre Sapir of the Bruegel think tank says it's too late to save Greece, but not Italy.
Luckily, Italy is not the Greek situation. Clearly, the system could not manage an Italian situation that would move like Greece.
Andre Sapir is from Bruegel, a think tank in Brussels.
Greece, as we know, has gone beyond sustainability of its debt. We are not there at all for Italy, and hopefully we will not be there ever because the Italian government is taking measures of discipline, of austerity.
But all along, many have argued that austerity is not the way out of the crisis. Sony Kapoor again.
No, the question of growth has not been addressed at all. What you have is the whole of the European Union now behaving like a small country, despite being the largest economy in the world. If you're a small, tiny country with a flexible exchange rate and the rest of the world economy is growing, austerity can restore competitiveness and can generate growth. But what worked for Sweden in the 1990s will definitely not work for the euro area now, at a time when both the United States and the Japanese economies are also not doing well.
Next year, a new EU bailout fund will be set up, a permanent war chest worth 500 billion euros. And the head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, is confident that more cash will also flow to her institution to fight the debt crisis.
They've decided to add to the resources of the International Monetary Fund by an amount of $270 billion. That is to be confirmed within 10 days. So that's a really good step in the right direction.
But doubts remain about whether the Eurozone's coffers are deep enough. European leaders are still very much learning the art of crisis management. Decisions are taken at a painfully slow pace. Leaders are hoping that the markets will wait until they shore up their defences. But in the worst-case scenario, the markets won't wait. And the fear is that the Eurozone crisis could still, potentially, take the rest of the global economy down with it. Vanessa Mock, Deutsche Welle Radio, Brussels.
For radio on the road, download the latest in news and current affairs from Deutsche Welle's European Weekly, Inside Europe. Go to dwworld.de/inside-europe and click on download. Or subscribe the show. Click on the podcast button on DW World's front page. That's dwworld.de for the latest podcasts. Don't leave home without one.
One other massive piece of fallout from this year's seemingly never-ending Eurozone crisis has been described as the Great Divorce, Britain's decision last week to effectively veto an EU treaty change that the rest of the bloc believed is needed to help beat Europe's financial crisis. UK Prime Minister David Cameron opposed the plans to change the Lisbon Treaty, claiming it would lead to a, quote, treaty within a treaty. He went on to warn that the proposals would benefit Eurozone members, those that have the euro as their currency, at the expense of countries like Britain, who don't. But the decision means that the UK is, once again, isolated from the rest of the continent, and now faces an uncertain future as part of the EU. Nick Martin with more from London.
I went to Brussels with one objective, to protect Britain's national interest.
As the EU now prepares a separate new treaty to help bring about closer integration, Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron has had to explain to his Parliament why the UK is once again on the outside looking in.
France and Germany said in their letter last week that the Eurozone should work on single market issues like financial regulation and competitiveness. That is why we required safeguards, and I make no apology for it.
Safeguards in the proposals to protect the City of London, a main driver of the UK economy, from having its wings clipped. Cameron feared London's dominance as one of the world's top financial centres was under threat.
Of course, I wish those safeguards had been accepted, but frankly, I have to tell the House the choice was a treaty without proper safeguards or no treaty. And the right answer was no treaty. It was not an easy thing to do, but it was the right thing to do.
Despite opposition claims that the move has left Britain isolated, many think the veto was just business as usual for UK-EU relations, which have been strained, let's face it, since the bloc's inception. Dr. Nick Anstead is from the London School of Economics and Political Science.
I think you can certainly see this event as being part of a continued pattern of Britain's attitude to Europe. In other words, an inability to articulate a vision of what an increasingly united, increasingly integrated Europe will look like. That's partially because we reject that idea, or we tend to feel quite uncomfortable with it, but it's also partially because we tend to think in tactical terms in our European negotiations.
Anstead says British negotiators think in terms of rebates and opt-outs rather than institutions. Officials, he says, often make the mistake of thinking of Europe as one bloc.
And that same theory of them and us also goes for the British public, who are by and large anti the EU. Approval for Cameron's decision to opt out is already showing up in opinion polls conducted since last week's summit. Figures show a gain for the Prime Minister's centre-right Conservative Party.
But Cameron's veto has not only isolated him from his European partners, it's also threatened a rift in Britain's coalition government. The Deputy Prime Minister and leader of Cameron's junior coalition partner, the Liberal Democrats, stayed away from the parliamentary debate this week. Nick Clegg says there was a real danger the UK could be marginalised. Opposition leaders have played up the threat to the UK economy. After all, more than half of Britain's trade is with other EU countries. Labour leader Ed Miliband told a parliamentary debate that Cameron had left Britain detached from the rest of Europe.
He has given up our seat at the table. He has exposed, not protected, British business. And he has come back with a bad deal for Britain. Many people feared an outcome of 17 countries going it alone. Few could have anticipated the diplomatic disaster of 26 going ahead and one country, Britain, being left behind.
Before last week's summit, Eurosceptics in Cameron's party were calling for a display of the British bulldog spirit during the Prime Minister's negotiations in Brussels. Many saw the veto as a chance to transfer more powers back to London. Political scientist Nick Anstead said David Cameron had promised the British people a referendum on any new EU treaties, and wonders how that influenced his decision.
If Britain had signed a renegotiated treaty, then there would have been a whole question about whether he would have had to honour this pledge, and certainly a lot of his backbenchers have already been talking in previous weeks that essentially not to offer a referendum would have been a breach of trust. And again, the sort of ghosts of previous Conservative Prime Ministers who were damaged or even removed because of their attitude to Europe would have haunted Mr Cameron.
As he looks to rebuild bridges with Europe, Cameron, it seems, will have his work cut out, trying to keep the public, his supporters and his EU partners happy. Nick Martin, Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
I'm Matt Herman in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. On the 14th of December, 100 years ago, Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen became the first human being to reach the South Pole. He remains a national hero in Norway, while his British competitor, Captain Robert Scott, has often been portrayed as a hapless amateur who never stood a chance in the race for the pole. Captain Scott died, actually, not long after discovering Amundsen's Norwegian flag already planted on the South Pole. But a century on, things have changed. The centenary celebrations surrounding the race to the pole have seen Scott emerging as a hero in the UK. And in this postcard, our favorite Norwegian journalist in Britain, Lars Bevanger, ponders whether he might have to reconsider his childhood views of the tragic Robert Scott.
To generations of Norwegians, Roald Amundsen has been the ultimate Norwegian. We all consider cross-country skiing a virtue and the exploring of wild mountain regions a national pastime. We've also always been a small people, used to being ruled by others, first Denmark, then Sweden. So it wasn't surprising that Roald Amundsen became an instant and lasting national hero when he skied to the South Pole and planted a Norwegian flag there in 1911, only 6 years after Norway gained independence from Sweden. What's more, he beat a Brit to it. Captain Robert Scott, a product of the greatest empire on earth since the Romans, beaten by an ordinary but pragmatic Norwegian. The might of the British Empire couldn't help Scott win the race to the South Pole. This was because, any Norwegian will tell you, he was an amateur, a foolish dreamer who could not ski like a Norwegian, who brought ponies to his polar expeditions, not dogs like a Norwegian. 100 years on, there's of course much chest-banging in celebration of our great polar hero. Take our Prime Minister. No simple commemorative speech for him. Like a true Norwegian, he got his skis on and walked to the South Pole himself last Wednesday, albeit after flying most of the way there. And yes, we do all ski. Visit the wintry forests of North Oslo on a Sunday and you can hardly move for cross-country skiing families. This is Amundsen's heritage. By contrast, the occasional smattering of snow brings total chaos to the British Isles. So I came to the UK believing Captain Robert Scott's merits were viewed by the locals as a footnote of history. But no, as the centenary drew close, Captain Scott emerged as a real British hero. Even more shocking, Roald Amundsen was presented as a bit of a trickster and a perpetrator of that most awful of sins here in the UK. He showed bad sportsmanship. British experts say Amundsen waited until the very last moment before telling Scott about his intentions to race him to the pole. A false head start, if you like. What's more, Scott didn't really set out to race anyone. His main aim was to gather scientific data. Scott and his teammates were found dead, carrying 25 kilos of fossilised rock, crucial proof of how the continents were once all joined together. It must have slowed them down, but they never considered abandoning the samples. So perhaps Captain Robert Scott was as much a hero as our own Roald Amundsen. It might be fitting to remember all the men in both expeditions this week and to remember that when they set out on their gruelling journeys, much of Antarctica was unmapped and even more dangerous than it is today. So here's to Amundsen and here's to Scott. Two real explorers who helped generations better understand the most inhospitable of Earth's continents. Lars Bevanger, Deutsche Welle Radio, Manchester.
Well, Lars, that's very magnanimous of you, but really we should be saying, here's to the packs of dogs that got them there. For more news and information, do visit our website, dwworld.de. And if you're a Twitter person, why not have a look for us over there? The show feed is at Inside Europe, all one word. And we try to put out the word on what's happening with the show there week to week. You are listening to Inside Europe. I'm Matt Herman, broadcasting from Bonn, on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. You're listening to Inside Europe. I'm Matt Herman in Bonn. In the next half hour, we're going to hear how a new initiative to make Istanbul's mosques more women-friendly is going. And we'll also hear from this entrepreneur in Berlin who has got himself into quite a pickle.
This started from very low investment, and it just started with an idea. And we managed to bring this idea to a level where we are able to live off it, but we always have to give the love back to the machines so the machines will feed us.
Not to worry, those machines he's depending on to feed him are friendly. They're old-timey photo booths, ones that he owns, those crazy hipsters. All that and more coming up in the next 30 minutes of Inside Europe. First, we'll move to Austria, where many are up in arms over plans by a set of far-right groups to hold a ball in the Hofburg Palace on Holocaust Remembrance Day, January 27th. The companies which book events at the palace say that their hands are tied. They are contractually obliged to let it go ahead, although they've told the organizers of the ball that it will be their last one there. As Kerry Skyring reports from Vienna, now the government is under pressure to step in.
As ball season approaches, Vienna's dancing schools are busy. Left, left, right, says the waltz instructor. But for many in Austria, the ball planned for January 27th, 2012, is far too far to the right. It's organized by the Vienna Kooperationsrings, an umbrella group for the far-right student groups known as Burschenschaften. It's to be held on the day Austria marks the liberation of the Auschwitz concentration camp. For Ariel Musikant, the leader of Vienna's Jewish community, this is a step too far.
The Hofburg is owned by the Austrian government, and it's a very symbolic place. Don't forget that Hitler stood there and gave his famous speech.
Human rights groups, the Jewish community, and the Greens welcome a decision to ban future balls by the Kooperationsrings, but are appalled that the 2012 event will go ahead. The companies, which manage the part of the palace used for balls, say they have to honor an existing contract.
Every Jewish family has had victims in the Shoah, and it's almost impossible to sit still and let this happen. So this is why we are engaging in very harsh protests and are calling upon the Austrian government to make sure that this ball does not take place on that day in the Hofburg, which is the residence of the Austrian president.
Demonstrations outside last year's ball of the Burschenschaften, the far-right student fraternities. Police tell the protesters they're going to clear the street. There are violent clashes and water cannon are used. The Freedom Party, which now rivals Austrian mainstream parties for popularity, has come out in support of the ball. MP Wolfgang Jung claims the ban is the result of what it calls a left-wing anarchistic mob. This makes me angry when I think about it, because the streets are given over to a rioting mob, he says. Next to that, we can't be accused of anything. And on being asked, does the Freedom Party reject right-wing extremism, he says, my God, we've done that so many times. Vienna's grand balls are not just for the Viennese. The rich and famous come from all over the world to dance under the chandeliers of palaces like the Hofburg. The Austrian Resistance Archives studies developments in right-wing extremism. Their expert, Herbert Scheidel, says far-right figures like France's Jean-Marie Le Pen and Belgium's Philippe de Winter have been guests. And he says the Vienna Kooperationsrings are clearly using it as a meeting point.
It's the umbrella organization of all student fraternities. They are pan-Germanistic, anti-Austrian. Yeah, and they have a long tradition in violence, in right-wing extremism, also in anti-Semitism and racism.
Scheidel says members of the Freedom Party are using the student fraternities to spread extreme-right ideology and unite its diverse European branches.
The Burschenschafter from Austria, they call themselves Ostmärker, they also try to move the German students' fraternity in the big umbrella organizations like Deutsche Burschenschaft, to move them more to the right, even more to the right.
The human rights group SOS Mitmensch has joined the campaign to press the government to ban the ball. Their president, Nadia Lorenz, points to an increase in right-wing violence.
Und militant rechtsextrem, das bedeutet dieser Tage auch.
Militant right-wing extremism. These days that means the massacre in Norway with dozens killed, the murder of 10 people in Germany, 9 of them with non-German backgrounds, fire attacks on an asylum home in Austria, a murderous attack in Upper Austria, yet the Interior Ministry sees no need for intervention.
The Freedom Party says it's pure coincidence the ball falls on the anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. Meanwhile, a spokesman for the governing Social Democrats says they welcome the decision to ban future balls and regret that the one already scheduled will go ahead. Ariel Musikant says they're out of step.
If the Austrian government would decide to cancel this ball, the worst that can happen is that they would have to pay some penalty. But what does a penalty mean in comparison to the terrible loss of image and damage this ball is doing to the reputation of Austria?
When the far right and the extreme right from across Europe choose their partners in the Hofburg Palace on January 27th, they'll dance the Viennese waltz. It involves steps and turns, primarily to the leader's right. Ironically, the turn to the left is known as a reversal. Kerry Skyring, Deutsche Welle Radio, Vienna.
If you've ever been to Turkey's largest city, Istanbul, as a tourist, you'll know that there are a wealth of beautiful old mosques. The Hagia Sophia, the Sultanahmet or Blue Mosque, the Süleymaniye, the Fatih, I really could go on. Many are beautifully restored and in great condition. But a lot of the city's other mosques, the hundreds of smaller neighborhood mosques that attract most ordinary Istanbulus for Friday prayers, are not in such good shape. And that goes double for the parts of those mosques that are sectioned off for women. Remember, men and women often do not pray together in Islam. In order to redress this imbalance, a project has been launched to make mosques more women-friendly. But as Dorian Jones reports, the initiative is not without its critics.
Kadri Avcı Erdemli, remonstrating with one of Istanbul's imams over the state of the women's section of his mosque. The small area designated for women here is filthy and cramped. Erdemli is Istanbul's deputy muftu, the city's second most senior official responsible for administrating the Islamic faith. And she's in charge of a radical program to make mosques women-friendly.
Kadınların namaz kıldığı yerler sadece burayı ele alıyoruz.
When a woman steps into a mosque, she is entering the house of God, and she should experience the same treatment. In front of God, men and women are equal. They have the same right to practice their religion.
Since March, Erdemli has sent out scores of teams to assess the facilities for women. Erdemli says the discoveries are shocking.
The teams discovered that many mosques had no toilets for women or indeed any place for them to wash. The areas for women were either filthy or used as storage depots. It's impossible for women to practice their faith in such surroundings.
But it's not just about cleaning up the mosques. Partitions separating men and women, whether it's a wall or a curtain, are also meant to come down. There appears to be broad support for the changes. 30-year-old Ayşe Gül is typical.
The women's sections are much smaller than the men's. They're almost like spaces left over, at the back or in the corner. It's time women got more and cleaner areas to pray in.
Ayşe Gül works in a nearby office building. She's part of Turkey's rapidly growing Islamic middle class, which emerged under the decade-long rule of the pro-Islamic AK Party. The AK Party has also lifted or eased restrictions in education and employment for women wearing Islamic headscarves. Professor İşdar Gözaydın of Istanbul's Dorç University is an expert on religious affairs. She says the opening up of the mosque to women is being fueled by the growing number of assertive Islamic professional females.
We see that more and more women are getting educated in the universities, more women are attending workplace and wants to be a part of this mosque system, and they want to take part in the social realm.
But not all are happy with such developments. Islamic newspaper columnists have strongly criticized the initiative, accusing it of encouraging women to leave the home and adopting Western lifestyles. And their criticism is being echoed by the male faithful. Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala. The call to prayer at Istanbul's Süleymaniye Mosque summons worshippers. Many here have misgivings about the initiative. 50-year-old Mehmet Gül is a local shopkeeper.
Böyle bir çalışma, yani kadının yerinin evi olduğu.
I think the place for women is their home. Especially on Friday prayers and during religious festivities, there's not enough room for men. It's not good for women to come.
But even among some women, there are reservations, especially over removing curtains and walls separating the male and female worshippers. This woman's view is not uncommon.
Women must be separated from the men. There has to be a curtain. This is a religious code of conduct, and the men should not be able to see them.
Deputy Muftu Erdemli acknowledges there is still much work to do in winning over the hearts and minds of the faithful, even among some women. But she's also convinced there can be no turning back. Dorian Jones, Deutsche Welle Radio, Istanbul.
On to another form of discrimination, one that's a bit more overt. In Romania, until the year 2000, homosexuality was illegal. It remains hugely controversial in the heavily Orthodox Christian country. Gay pride events in cities like Bucharest and Cluj often draw the violent ire of far-right groups. So against this backdrop, a new, frank documentary about gay life has been attracting plenty of attention. The film is called Two of Us, and it depicts the day-to-day experiences of a young gay couple in Bucharest. Our correspondent Tom Wilson met up with the director at the premiere of the film to find out more.
Just a few weeks ago, the film Noi Doi, or Two of Us, saw its Bucharest premiere. In a fitting illustration of just how much opposition there is to homosexuality in Romania, the premiere itself was disrupted by an impromptu demonstration. A group of about 10 men burst into the auditorium, chanting slogans like "Romania won't tolerate gays," waving flags and setting off flares. The rest of the screening passed without incident and ended with a friendly questions and answers session. I met up with director Claudio Mitcu to find out how he came to make this film.
It's the first time in Romania that a documentary has been made about a gay couple. It was something that at a certain point was necessary. It had to be done.
The main problem, however, was finding people who'd consent to be filmed.
I looked and looked. It was very difficult to find participants. I met lots and lots of people, but nobody would agree to it. There were two reasons for not wanting to appear. The first is people's families, and the second is the risk of people at work finding out, and you could find yourself discriminated against.
Accept, a gay rights NGO, however, came to his aid.
In the end, I went to the Accept organization, and after a few months, I met Christy, the main character in the film. After 2 years of filming, the documentary Us Two was released.
I headed off to Accept's Bucharest headquarters to meet Christy himself. He explained why he agreed to take part.
I've always wanted to do things, to get involved, to fight for our rights, and that's why I agreed to take part in this project.
The film is a fly-on-the-wall look at their relationship. In a way, its banality is part of its appeal, as Christy explained.
A gay couple is just as normal as a straight couple. We cook, we eat, we go into town, we go shopping, we argue, we get jealous.
However, because of the controversial subject, they found themselves running into problems.
Unfortunately, not even our friends would allow themselves to be filmed. They were scared of the exposure. Their parents didn't know, or their friends didn't know. And they didn't want people to find out their sexual orientation from the documentary, so they didn't consent to be filmed.
When he began filming, Christy's parents didn't know he was gay. The film itself played a part in them finding out.
My parents found out from the internet. They looked me up on Google and saw I worked at Accept. They also found out about the film at one point. I wanted to come out in front of them, but they found out on their own.
Christy's parents didn't react positively.
It's very difficult in comparison to other countries. It matters what the majority thinks, and here, the general view about the gay community isn't a positive one.
The cinema invasion by a group affiliated to the New Right political movement is a reminder that Christy is actually placing himself in quite a dangerous position.
I'm worried that someone might recognize me on the street. They could react very badly. Perhaps it could be someone from the New Right or other anti-gay groups. So yes, I am scared.
Thankfully, the only reactions he's had have been positive.
People have recognized me, yes. There were two girls, and they recognized me from the film trailer. They congratulated me. It was okay. But I've not had any negative experiences yet, and I hope that I won't have any.
Film director Claudiu is the first to admit the importance of what Christy and George have done.
It's extremely brave. I really have to thank them for their courage. For many years, I looked for people to star in the film, and everyone refused to appear. So honestly, I've come to appreciate their courage more than ever. What they've done is a real act of bravery.
And perhaps most importantly of all, the film is certainly getting people talking about homosexuality in Romania. Tom Wilson, Bucharest, Deutsche Welle Radio.
I'm Matt Herman in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. All familiar with the American cowboy, the roving ranch hand. It's an occupation that endures today. But you're probably unaware that Italy, too, has a cowboy tradition. Called butteri, Italian cowboys roam the Maremma region, which straddles southern Tuscany and northern Lazio, herding the wild cattle of the coastal marshes there. But while there are still quite a few American cowboys left, Italy's butteri are disappearing fast. In fact, only a few remain. Gene Di Marino visited the region to see what's happened to the wild men of the Maremma.
Two generations of Italian cowboys, or butteri as they're called here, join in song. Giovanni Travagliati and Piero Crociani whiled away hours on horseback singing like this as they guarded the livestock in their care. It's an unfamiliar sound these days. The butteri are a dying breed. Like the cattle they once watched, there's little need for them anymore.
It was a tough life. You had to get up very early in the morning before the cattle.
Giovanni Travagliati spent more than 80 years in the saddle. Now aged 102, for decades he was capo butero, or chief cowboy for the Corsini, a noble Italian family with large estates in Tuscany. He taught Piero Crociani everything he knows. Crociani recalls long hours in the saddle, helping cattle give birth, protecting them from wolves and poachers.
It was from 5 in the morning until 9 at night, Monday to Sunday. Then on Monday you began again. You didn't have a day off. We lived on the farm in a house the prince had given us, so whatever happened, they'd call and we'd go back to work, day or night. Sunday, even Christmas Day.
The Maremma region on the west coast of Italy was famous for its butteri. Mostly marshland, it was dotted with large landholdings, its pasture too poor for little but raising livestock. It was a wild country that selected tough men to tame the wild Maremmana horses and tend the long-horned Maremmana cattle.
The cows were pretty wild. If you went to touch their young, they attacked. They're very protective. The horses were like this too. You had to know how to move. But then here we still are, the two of us. We've bred a lot of horses and cows, and we're here. We've never had an accident.
But times have changed in the Maremma. You can now count the number of butteri working here on one hand. Stefano Pavin is capo buttero on the Alberese farm, around 100 kilometres north of Rome. There used to be 7 cowboys here. Now he's just one of 4. The Alberese estate has reduced its herd of Maremmana cattle. The breed's no longer used as a beast of burden. Tractors took care of that. And Pavin says there's not much demand either for its beef.
It's a meat that's very lean. It has very little fat. It's darker, so people don't want it. They are used to light-colored meat, with veins of fat running through it.
Farmers do receive a small subsidy for raising the Maremmana cattle, a breed at risk of extinction. But it's not enough to offset the costs, so they're getting out of the business and letting the cows and the cowboys go.
This is a breed that gives little return. While a normal beef animal gives a yield of 65% on the cow, ours give 50%. A private owner or concern would never go ahead with this.
Piano piano, si tranquillizza.
Piero Crociani is one of the casualties of this trend. A few years ago, he was laid off from the farm that had employed him nearly all his adult life.
I received a phone call from the owners saying that they'd decided to change the direction of the business. They were selling the cattle and I had to stay at home. A little while ago, I began working at another farm. And even there, they've begun to change direction and are selling all the livestock. So the trade is finishing.
Piero's now trying to get a business of his own off the ground. A skilled buttero, he trains horses, offers riding lessons, and organises horseback treks. He wants the authorities to give more incentives to restock the Maremmana herds and encourage the return of the cowboys.
It's more than a trade or occupation. It's part of the culture. If there are no more buttery in the Maremma, it's no longer the Maremma. The Maremma too is finished.
Although he's now living a hand-to-mouth existence, Piero says given the opportunity to go back, he'd only change one thing. He would have worked even harder to keep the cattle and preserve a way of life. Jean Di Marino, Deutsche Welle Radio in the Maremma.
All right, we're all through with the home on the range now. We're moving to the startups of the 21st century. New technology and new ideas. That's what underpins new business models, right? Well, not always. Take, as an example, a couple of Berliners who have reintroduced some very old technology to the streets of the German capital and are now enjoying quite a bit of success, 2 euros at a time. They're reintroducing the Fotoautomat, you know, those analog photo booths that produce grainy self-portraits in strips of 4 photos. So, Deutsche Welle's Jonathan Gifford did his hair, had a shave, and stepped inside the booth to find out more.
It could be that you need a photo for an ID card. You might want to share a romantic moment. You may have had one too many drinks with friends. But for whatever reason, parting the curtain, feeding in your money, and striking a pose in a photo booth, or Fotoautomat, as they're known in Germany, can help you capture a moment in time. And at 10 different locations around Berlin, Fotoautomats have been reintroduced and are becoming increasingly popular. We're not talking about the new digital booths that print crisp, clean and colour pictures. Instead, these are the analogue, mechanical machines that produce grainy, black and white pictures that are full of character. Ole Kreschmann is one of the co-founders of the Photo Booth project.
We came across a photo booth in Switzerland and thought it would be a very cool item to bring to Berlin. This is a technology that's older than 100 years, and digital version hasn't been achieved that delivers this kind of quality.
But when Kleshman talks photographic quality, he's not referring to perfect contrast and sharp focus, but rather a type of counter-movement flying in the face of digital precision and electronic airbrushing. Susanna Kraus is a Berliner who's also turning old photographic technology into new business. She's revived an old camera and technique pioneered by her father in the 1970s, a kind of giant photo booth which takes giant portraits on a one-to-one scale.
You see here the enormous light, and you have here the place about where you go when you make your picture.
At €300 per photo, Klaus's work is on a completely different scale to the street corner photo booths, but she came into contact with the photo booth project through a contact at AGFA, as they both searched for the special paper this type of photography requires. The paper itself was commonly available in years past, but completely went out of production when modern printing techniques became commonplace. Because the image is cast directly onto the paper, as opposed to a negative or film, each shot is unique. Something Klaus believes is very special.
Sometimes it can also be very easy and very light not to have 500 pictures on my Mac and to select and to go in Photoshop and to work on it. You only have one. And you know after you have done this that nothing is changed. Not before and not after. You can trust your eyes on these photos.
But as many in business will tell you, special quality comes at a price. Aske Donst is Kleshman's partner in the return of the photo booth, and he says that keeping these old machines running is no simple task.
Yeah, it's a lot of work to keep it running, to repair all the stuff that sometimes broke, and also to keep it clean, because especially in Berlin, there's a lot of graffiti, a lot of vandalism, and so, yeah, we have to be there every day, actually.
So with such labour-intensive maintenance demands, how do the two make ends meet? Kleshman explains that in some way it's a labour of love. By working with an extended network of family and friends, the old-school photo booths have spread from Berlin throughout Germany and now to cities further afield like Paris, Vienna and London.
We do visit the booths way more often than once a week. We are a group of friends that took on the challenge to keep the 10 booths that we were operating in Berlin clean, tidy, and delivering nice, crispy photos. And this is a 24-hour job, which we share. We split up the weeks and take shifts day by day.
The spread of the photo booths has very much depended on contacts between this network of people committed to the cause. Offers to expand their operations have come from places and people beyond this network. However, the photo booth project prefers to expand purely through family and friends. The photo booths in Berlin tend to be prominently placed in public areas, and the market is pretty well saturated. In fact, to find space for one of their newer booths, Kleshman and Donst chose to hire out a shopfront near their workshop in Prenzlauer Berg, northeast of Alexanderplatz.
This started from very low investment, and it just started with an idea. And we managed to bring this idea to a level where we are able to live off it, but we have always have to give the love back to the machines so the machines will feed us.
So the next time you're searching for a new idea or the solution to a particular problem, remember, there may be low-tech approaches or forgotten machinery that provides something that is truly unique. All it takes is a little love. Jonathan Gifford for Deutsche Welle Radio.
If you want to drop us a line, we're always very happy to receive listeners' feedback. Our email address is europe@dw-world.de. Or you can send us a letter to Inside Europe, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bonn, Germany. We hope you'll tune in again next week. On behalf of my colleague Neil King and our sound engineer Helmut Schwede, thanks for listening. It's goodbye from me, Matt Herman. Inside Europe comes to you from Deutsche Welle Radio in Bonn.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the programme. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.